Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Further from sobriety. So sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving.
And now it's time for Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art, with your hosts, Leslie, M. Scott Jones, and Clinton Johnston. And now,
well here we are.
Here we are. Good morning, Sunday morning. Whether you are an art breaker, an art taker, an art faker, or an art partaker, welcome all, because of course all are welcome to Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art. I'm the one they call Clinton, and I'm here with a woman who is so woke, all Ambien wilts around her. Leslie, I'm Scott Jones.
Well, good morning, Clinton. Yes, all Ambien does wilt around me, mostly because I don't sleep.
I'm with you.
I just don't. Like, the past three nights, because, you know, I started school again.
Mm.
So, like, the past three nights, it's like I've gotten back into that college thing where you stay up until 2 a.m. So, yeah.
See, here's the thing. I never left that. From college.
You never
I just
got
like
out of that?
I graduated barely. I graduated and like they gave me the diploma and I was waiting for them to give me my sleep patterns back and
right.
They're just like, "No, we're keeping
like,
those."
Like,
"No. You don't. No. Those are
Sorry.
Ours." That's the price you pay. We have sucked the sleep from you. That's what college they're sleep I've determined they're sleep sucking demons. That's what they
are. That's what they are. Okay, so why did I sign up for this again? I don't Okay.
Because you got a pretty little paper from it.
Yeah, you get that pretty little piece of paper. And unfortunately, you know, you need that pretty little piece of paper in this society to, you know, prove that you're worth something.
There you go. To prove that you can go without sleep for
right.
a long, long amount of
That's
time.
That's actually what the diploma's going to say. Yeah. Sleep deprived. Magna cum laude.
I thought, isn't that what magna cum laude means?
I don't know.
I didn't major in Latin.
I haven't gotten a Latin class.
They don't
yet,
let
so
you
I
major in Latin so that you can't figure out what magna cum laude really means.
No, the only Latin I know is from West Wing.
Really?
Yes.
What Latin do you know?
Post hoc ergo propter hoc.
Oh yes. Oh yes, of course.
That's the only Latin that stuck. I am so sorry. I need to apologize to my Latin teacher from high school. That's all I remember. I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson. I love you.
You should never have to apologize for your extensive use of the West Wing.
Actually, he would be proud of my extensive use of the West Wing. He really would.
Now it's time to go back and binge the first four seasons of the West Wing.
Right. Because after the fifth season, Aaron stopped writing. And,
he stopped being totally involved.
It did change a little bit. I mean, it was still great, but it did change a little bit. Right.
Yeah. Once the showrunner runs.
Yeah.
Speaking of a show, let's run to our show.
Let's do that.
Didn't think I could still do a segue, did you?
You know what? I was waiting for the segue. waiting to figure out what the segue was going to be. You did very well.
Thank you very much. I was quite pleased with myself.
Yeah.
I was quite surprised. Let's run to our show and our very first guest returning to the show. Thank you so much for being here. Jane Allison, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. I also haven't slept, so we're all together.
Ha ha!
The life of an artist.
Something like that.
So, it's nice to see you again.
It's good to be back.
You have been busy.
I have.
Yes, you've been writing. And you've been writing this time about writing.
That's right. I've been writing about writing because I talk about writing all the time. And I actually woke up at 4 a.m. recently, so I must have been asleep and thought, I could actually write this instead of just going in and teaching it. I can write all this stuff down. So, that's what I did.
Cool. So tell us about this new book, Meander, Spiral, and Explode. Or is it just, it's Meander, Spiral, Explode?
It's Meander, Spiral, Explode, Design and Pattern in Narrative. You got the colon there and then the rest of the description.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a book that is for writers and also for real serious readers. And it's more or less my polemic against one of the ways we're most often taught how to write, which is to follow this very prescriptive form, which is the narrative arc, the dramatic arc.
Okay, so please talk about this, because I must admit I am dedicated to that prescription. I am all in on the narrative arc. I am like the flood comes.
Please
and
teach
I
him.
Build a narrative arc. Right, and I write for 40 days and 40 nights, and I wait for the dove to come.
I wish that were the arc. That would be so much better. No, this is not that arc. Well, I'll be serious. The narrative arc, it's also called the dramatic arc. I mean, haven't you ever heard people talk about, like, what's the arc of the story? Or this is the, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah,
this is
yeah.
the character
and like,
arc.
And I do that all the time. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
all
always.
The time.
And it gets up my nose every time. I actually have a visceral reaction because I find it so limiting. And also, it is really prescriptive. And we got the idea thousands of years ago, pre-Latin, actually, from Aristotle. And he was talking about classical tragedy. He was talking about drama. Mm-hmm. And so he described how you have a situation where there's a character and he's in some kind of conflict and you're kind of going towards complication and then you reach this climactic moment and then there's a fall, which is true in ancient drama. And mm-hmm. he studied them. You know, he dissected these things as if they were snakes to see what their spines were. Mm-hmm. And so he saw that that is what happens in the best tragedy. But he did not know about novels or fiction because they didn't exist yet. And then 2,000 years later, this German scholar was also studying tragedy and drama.
Gustav Freytag.
Genau, that's the man. sorry, I lived in Germany for too long. but he gave us Freytag's triangle, and it's the same thing. It's he took the ideas of Aristotle. He studied Shakespearean tragedy and also Greek tragedy again, and he drew this thing that we call Freytag's triangle or Freytag's pyramid. And it's all about situation, conflict, intensifying conflict, and climax, and then fall. And that's great. It works for tragedy, but fiction isn't tragedy. We have different kinds of stories, and we have different ways of doing things. I mean, for one thing, you read it, you don't see it performed. So I don't understand why that's been something that's foisted upon fiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can create great fiction, but it's mm-hmm. not the only thing. And then there's, I don't like the fact that it comes from tragedy, so why does fiction rely on it? B, I don't like the fact that writers are told to do anything. I find that kind of prescriptiveness, I just get my back up at that. And C, there's a whole history of this pattern of like conflict and tension and greater tension and then climax and then fall. What does that sound like? It's sexual. And it's not just sexual, it's masculosexual. Mm. And it is not the way women experience sex. And
amen, sister.
And it's not, and there are scholars who will say this is what fiction is. You know, it requires this sort of tumescence and detumescence and, this orgasmic moment. And I'm just thinking, why? And if it is sexual, why can't it be feminine sexual? Mm. Why could it not be something that's a little bit more Ripley and there's lots of little peaks like that, not mm-hmm. like the big bang? So I said I wouldn't rant, but here I am. So this book is kind of against that arc, or it's arguing for looking at different kinds of patterns that exist in the natural world that are not, this thing which is like a wave.
So if someone's writing fiction, let's say, a romance novel. So the normal track for a romance novel is, boy meets girl. They have some sort of conflict trying to figure out how they can be together, and then they overcome the conflict and live happily ever after. So how would you write that story without that arc?
I probably wouldn't. I probably would use that arc for that story.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because I think it really works well for some kinds of stories. And when they're more formulaic like that, then it's probably perfect.
So you're not about the abolishment
no.
of the arc.
No.
But the abolishment of the prescription.
Yes.
And the exclusionary prescription.
Yes, exactly. No, I think the arc can be fantastic. I mean, I have used it myself in my first novel. It can be exactly what you need. I mean, it works for certain kinds of tragedy, obviously, and I think it works for stories like that where, you are reaching this great moment of climax. But a lot of stories are not like that. A lot of the ways that we write, about real experience, even if it's fictionalized, they just don't have that. I mean, you don't go through life and have the big climax and then everything settles down.
So, if only.
how much of these thoughts were in your mind when you were writing Nine Island? Because thinking back to Nine Island, it seems like it really takes from this alternative view. Because I remember it being a more discursive experience.
Thank you. That it exactly is that. And I'd been thinking about different ways to structure books for a long time, but I hadn't come up with the idea that I came up with for this book. Nine Island is more meandering. So there's discursiveness. And there is kind of a moment where a lot of things come together, but it sort of falls apart again and rises again. And it has a system more like that. What I discovered, which was actually, I don't believe in epiphanies, and yet I kept having them. So it's sort of
right.
like, what the hell?
But not one big epiphany, but a lot of
little epiphanies. Lots of little epiphanies, that's right. that's different. I had been working on different books, I mean, reading books and teaching them that, and stories that take on these different shapes. And, you know, I knew I was talking about them and saying, see, there really isn't an arc there. There's something else going on here. But I hadn't put anything together aside from the fact that I liked more extravagant or more experimental form. But then when I was deciding it was time to write a book and, you know, make some use out of all of this instead of just talking about it, I realized I needed to know a lot more about patterns altogether. And I read this book, 1974 book called Patterns in Nature by a guy named Peter Stevens. And I tell you, my brain was blown because something I had not realized is that because of all different forces in nature, we keep getting the same patterns again and again and again.
Right.
And he calls them nature's darlings. So a meander is one. A spiral is one. A kind of explosive or radial shape is one, like, you know, the sun or a gerbera, you know, a daisy, or dropping water in a pool. Fractals, you know, you've got one thing that keeps branching and branching and branching. Or cellular or network patterns. And so there's all of these, it's beyond my skill set to comprehend, but all sorts of things like gravity and fluid dynamics and God knows what. And geometry really come together and make these things keep happening. So you can, like, look at your hand, and you've got spirals in your fingertips, and make a fist, and there's another one.
Right.
And your ear does one.
Yeah.
You know, and your hair might meander, or it might have wavelets, like yours does. And your eye is an explosive pattern, as is your nipple, for instance. So, you know, our bodies are made of these things. They exist everywhere in nature at every single scale. Artists have been using them for millennia, and I just thought, why don't writers? And then I realized, oh, all these books I've been studying all this time, actually, they fall into these different categories. And so I thought, oh, my God. Anyway, so this book is about, so meander, spiral, explode as two of the patterns that recur that I found in these books. Epiphany, huh?
Yeah.
If you're a writer, it's
see, now we need a mic drop moment. That's okay.
Huh, that's interesting.
And see, Clinton and I are both writers, so now we are both sitting here going, okay, how do I write? how do I make the next thing I write?
But here's the thing, we're both writers, but we're both different writers. I mean, because I write almost, these days, I write almost, and for a long, long time, I write almost exclusively theater. And so I'm wondering whether or not, I'm wondering how that works in terms of theater writing, because I must admit, when I look at plays, every once in a while I'll see a play, especially a new play, and I'll sit there and I'll think, what is this, like, where is the arc, what is this going to, what is this play about? There's something really, you know, there's something really powerful in the, I've introduced something to the audience, and you're now waiting to have either something found or some question answered or some secret revealed. And you know things are over when, bam, that happens. Right?
Yeah,
it's an effective way to tell a story.
It is.
And a dramatic way to tell a story.
But I'm also thinking about something like For Colored Girls, you know, which was written in the 70s and started as a movement piece and then had words put to it afterwards, and that kind of, and that story, although it is very dramatic theater and does have a visceral effect on the audience, there really isn't an arc.
Well, but if you look at the individual pieces,
the individual pieces have an arc, but the entirety of it is kind of like, it's kind of a meander because it's all of these different basically monologues or vignettes with these women telling their stories, and at the end of it, it's like, okay, this was our story. Like, there's,
and yet
the audience gets to kind of make up what it means to them.
And yet, she leaves for her final piece. What is it? One Evening with Bo Willie Brown.
Yeah,
yeah. She leaves the really big one, the one that has this big emotional punch.
Yeah,
for the final piece, and I think that that mimics that type of arc. So it's a lot of different, it's a lot of different pieces that don't necessarily have a narrative arc through it.
Right.
But you still have that dramatic thing where you're going, they're fleeing, and then you have this one big piece that gives you this emotional, oh my God. And then it closes.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, it's an explosion at the end. It's not, you don't build up to it and then have a resolution. It is this huge explosion of sadness and hurt, and at the same time, joy and like celebration, which is an interesting moment in and of itself.
And just to be clear for our audience, we're talking about Antasaki Shange's For Color Girls Who've Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. Don't watch the movie.
Do not watch the movie. They butchered it. But anyway.
One of the things, though, I think is that the arc can... Where I see the arc always is inside the reader. And that is the experience you have. It's like, here you are, an innocent reader or viewer, whatever the case. And you don't know anything. And you come into it and you get more and more and more involved. And then finally you leave the thing and then the energy ends. But so there can be an arc in the reading experience, even if the text itself is taking a different shape. Like for Colored Girls, I'm thinking it might be more like a cellular shape where you've got one piece, another piece, another piece. And so as a reader, because the first book I read that made me think about all of this 18 years ago was also in pieces like that. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it's me, the reader, trying to figure out what is connecting them, where is all of this going. You know, these are totally separate pieces, but there's something in common and something is building in me as I start to put together, oh, that is what all of this is. And it becomes more than all of the parts.
Well, and I would think that that would be a more engaging and visceral experience for the reader, or if it's live theater, for the watcher, because you have to be more involved in the story because you're actually doing more of the work than the piece is.
Exactly.
In some ways.
All right. Well, let's take a break for a moment and then get back to this conversation. This is fascinating. We're here. This is Homegrown. And we'll be right back after this drop.
Hello, everyone. This is Dina Jennings, your local luthier and physician. I'm at Homegrown, your show about local art at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
19 minutes past the hour, if you're just joining us here on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art. I'm Clinton. Leslie's here, and we're here with author Jane Allison. What up, Jane?
Hi.
Talking about her new book, Meander, Spiral, Explode, and I don't have the colon. What's the colon?
The colon, and then it's Design and Pattern in Narrative.
Meander, Spiral, Explode, Design and Pattern in Narrative. You've got a piece that you can read from it, right?
I do. I'm going to read from the opening, because why not?
Why not?
And it's kind of interestingly off the topic, so how about that? okay. In 1926, an Irish designer named Eileen Gray, who'd created lots of gorgeous, strange furniture but scarcely a house, began designing a ship-like villa on the south coast of France that would drive the famed architect Le Corbusier wild. Corbu had just announced that a house was a machine to live in, but Gray thought, no, a house is a person's shell, a skin, and should respond to how she lives. To start designing, Gray studied how she and her housekeeper move throughout the day. She made diagrams of their motions and those of the sun to reveal natural patterns. Loops in the kitchen, deep lines by the windows, meanders through the living room, an organic choreography. The house she then built on rocks by the sea expressed this choreography. A mouth-like entry pulled you in, screens and mirrors unfolded from walls like wings, windows and shutters opened in all directions for the right air, light, or view at any time of day. On her plans, she drew lines showing ways you could move, look, and live in this house, her pathways transformed to design. I love how Eileen Gray designed, and I really love how much it maddened the bombastic Corbu. And I think that Gray's way of working from life to art could describe writing, too. Because writers, as writers, we, you know, go about our lives, and we look at things, and we pay attention to things, and we sort of see patterns, and you need patterns in order to write, and then we try and convert everything into you know, language and passages through which our writers are supposed to travel. And then when you finish reading something, it's only then you can kind of look down at what you've read and see the design of the whole and see the pattern and see the kind of picture that's there. So I really do love how Eileen Gray did this kind of organic way of doing it rather than this prescriptive, this is how you walk through the house and I want you to have this view first and then this view.
Yeah.
She did it kind of the other way around. And so this is a way for me to see how we as writers can also think a little bit more organically about the paths that we carve through our books and how we might find different patterns that express reality a little bit more than the one that we're prescribed all the time.
So what fascinates me is how you're talking about patterns and about finding new patterns, and that you're not talking, you're not anarchistic about it. You're not talking about the abolition of structure, but finding new structures and introducing alternate structures, and specifically structures based on structures that we already maybe have an intuitive understanding of and familiarity with because there are structures that we see in ourselves, in nature. What is your thought about the necessity for structure? What's your relationship to structure?
I believe in structure, and I think it's probably my age and what I studied. I studied classical mythology when I was in college, and you know that was in the day of the structuralists, and so it sort of was put in me. But I'm the kind of person who does need structure. But I like to find the kinds of structures that really work best rather than, like I said, have one imposed on me. So, I mean, slice of life writing is beautiful, but that's not what I'm talking about here. So the books and the stories I'm looking at in this book, I don't know that any of the writers set out to follow a certain structure. Mm-hmm. I think it was just naturally the one that they needed. So Jamaica Kincaid's book, Mr. Potter, which is one of my favorites, where she sort of creates the father that she had but never knew. And she creates him in her own image. It's this incredibly aggressive, like strong kind of feminist Genesis book. But the structure of it is kind of spiraling, where she's sort of acting like a witch and kind of repeating things until she more or less conjures him to life. So I don't imagine she thought, I'm going to write a spiraling book, but it has that sensation. So I think that's what interests me most, is when you're just following something that you need to. Like, I think a spiral is something, if you're being obsessively retrospective, you might be sort of spiraling into the past in some way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a book, Mary Robeson, I love, called Why Did I Ever? And it's all about a trauma that she's avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in like little teeny fragments, and it's totally crazy and madcap, but it's all spinning around the fact that her son, that the narrator's son, was just raped and tortured. And she just can't even talk about it or look at it, but it's there. And you kind of know you're always circling around it. So I think these shapes can be the natural shapes that some stories want. And you know, in ones I've written, I have like these little waves that keep coming and going, like we were talking about earlier, or a kind of meander, because it's not about like, let's get to the big dramatic moment. It's no, let's look around, let's put it off, let's consider other things.
So you have the launch event for the book on the 2nd at New Dominion Bookshop.
Yes.
So are you going to read from the book and then take questions, or how's that going to work?
I'm still figuring that out. I think I'm going to read a little, talk a little, and I do have a PowerPoint.
Oh, awesome.
I know. This is my first PowerPoint. So I have lots of images of all of these different shapes. So there will be stuff to look at, even if I'm droning on.
Well, don't think of it as droning on as much as meandering.
Meandering,
yes.
You're meandering. Like a lovely spring brook.
That's how I feel.
This is fascinating. This is really very challenging. And it's and as you can tell, it's really making me rethink a bunch of things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm actually in the middle of writing two different pieces, and they are the subject matter is very different. And I'd actually like kind of hit a wall with one of them. Like, okay, I know what I want to do, but how do I get there? So this might be something to like look into, to like just, you know, abandon the structure that I have set up and see where the story goes without imposing that, and then put it back together.
And then put it back together, right? And then reinsert that.
Did you run these ideas and these revelations, these epiphanies, past other writers when you were putting this together? And if so, what was the response?
Mostly, I've been running it by my students, so the grads and the undergrads. Because even though some of them are absolutely radical and rebellious and strong-willed and, I mean, brilliant, original, all that, they still talk about, well, what's the arc of the story going to be?
Right.
And I think, like, what is wrong with you? Why are you thinking that way? And so I've been kind of testing these things out on them. Mm-hmm. So I did a course last year with undergrads. We read a bunch of the books and stories that are in this. And I was trying to get them to, draw the shape that they saw in the story, or diagram, you know, the movement of it. So I've run it by a lot of students and a couple of my colleagues. But since a lot of writers are wedded to the arc,
yeah,
I am waiting for the moment to come when they start calling me to account.
As well, you should, because even here, I'm like, but.
Yes, yes.
Don't take my arc.
It served me so well.
It took me so long to get a good understanding of it. I worked so hard on it.
No, I really, the arc is beautiful. I mean, if you think of the arc as a wave, then it's different. I mean, I love, you know, a wave, a wonderful crashing wave, but it's just not the only one.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, Jane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming. The book, let me see, because I want to be able to see the whole thing.
Right?
Yeah. All right. So the book is Meander, Spiral, Explode, Design and Pattern in Narrative by Jane Allison. The release date is the release date the same as the event date? Release date and event date, April 2nd. Catch her at New Dominion Bookshop, of course, because borders are for people to build walls on.
Yes!
Jane, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been great being here.
All right. Let us talk about things that are coming up this week.
Things. All the things.
All the things.
All of the things.
Here are just some of the artistic events that are happening this week, currently running right now until April 13th.
Yes, I got yes.
No, but let me just say, could you mention this?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Currently running from now to April 13th, the American Shakespeare Center presents the 2019 Actors Renaissance season featuring Henry IV Part 1 and The Merry Wives of Windsor by William Shakespeare. Anne Page Hates Fun, Arden of Faversham at the Blackfriars Theater in Stanton. Last chance to check out these art exhibits if their venues are open today. We're talking Lee Christmas Halsted showing her waterscapes at the Charlottesville Writer House. Susan Patrick showing her watercolors and multimedia drawings in Debris at the New Dominion Bookshop. Susan was just here a couple weeks ago talking about that exhibit. Pete Morris's acrylic painting show, Northern Neck Nature, showing at Top Knot Studio. If they're open, you can catch them today. Currently running until April 14th, Hello Dolly at Four County Players. Also currently running.
Hello Dolly.
Currently running a staged reading of the, actually last chance to get a see a staged reading of The Exonerated, a play about people incorrectly sentenced to death at Live Arts Theater. That's today. April 4th, the UVA MFA reading series continues with students Sasha Stein, Provost, and Miriam Grossman reading their work at, of course, the New Dominion Bookshop. April 5th, on First Friday, catch these art openings on and around the downtown mall. UVA students Alden Myers and Liz Wimbish open their photography exhibit, A Place to Call, at the Writer House. Michael Fitz and Megan Reed have objectified their joint exhibit of their photorealistic style of paintings at Second Street Gallery. Retired UVA medieval art professor exhibits... Oh, I forgot to put her name down. I'm sorry. But she exhibits her patterned images, which are the result of photography and Photoshop at New Dominion Bookshop. And painter Ken Horn and sculptor Robert Strini at New City Arts Welcome Gallery both have a joint exhibit. On April 6th, award-winning poet Irene P. Matthew reads from her work at the Bridge Progressive Arts Initiative. From April 6th to April 14th, the Persimmon Tree Players present Out of Sight, Out of Murder at the Carysbrook Performing Arts Center in Fork Union. And on April 7th, auditions for Bright Star by Steve Martin and Edie Brickell take place at Shannon Arts in Stanton.
I'm sorry, whoa. Go back to that. Steve Martin and Edie Brickell.
April 7th, auditions for Bright Star with music, lyrics, and words all by Steve Martin and Edie Brickell.
Holy crap!
Yep, at Shannon Arts in Stanton.
Ooh.
And for your music options this week.
Today, Nan McMillan at Batesville Market at 1 p.m. Sue Harlow at Pippin Hill Farm and Vineyards at 1 p.m. The University of Virginia Chamber Music Series welcomes the Ravana String Quartet playing pieces by Beethoven and Dvorak. I love Dvorak. Nobody ever plays Dvorak. King
Jump
Golden Banshee. King Golden Banshee at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. On the 2nd, Lewis Smith and Friends at Fellini's. On the 3rd, Aaron Lunsford at the Shebeen Pub. LG and Woo-hoo! Friends at the Whiskey Jar. On the 3rd, Timeless Generation at Dirty Nelly's. On the 4th, Face Made for Radio at the Whiskey Jar. And the Charlottesville Baroque Ensemble at Three Notched Road.
No, they're called Three Notched Road.
Oh,
Three Notched Road is the Charlottesville Baroque Ensemble.
Called Three Notched Road. Okay, good. Presents Sorrowful Mysteries, Rosemary Sonatas of Heinrich
Bieber.
Ah, there's supposed to be a space there. Heinrich Beaver for... Oh, wow. Really? Scordatura?
Scordatura violin and continuo.
Ooh. Okay, now we got Italian up in here. Oh, at Holy Comforter Catholic Church. Okay, yes, I'm meandering through this. On the 5th, Dropping Julia at the Whiskey Jar, Driving Sideways at Holly's Diner, An Evening with Mighty Joshua at the Front Porch Roots Music School, the Sally Rose Band at Glass House Runner. Hey, Sally, come back on the show, would ya? Susan Munson and Mojo at Dirty Nelly's. Hey, Susan. On the 6th, UVA McIntyre Department of Music Emeritus Faculty Member Judith Shayton presents Hearing Things, Music by Judith Shayton, a concert of acoustic, electroacoustic, and digital music at UVA's Old Cabell Hall.
Word, that sounds interesting. That apparently that's a collection of music that she's written over years.
Really?
Like, it's basically a retrospective of her going through,
wow,
of her journey through starting with
cool
acoustic music and then building in electroacoustic music and then just going digital.
That's freaky.
I'm saying.
Blue Ridge Irish Music School play a session at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. The Bob Bonetta Jazz Quartet with Dick Orange at Seaville Coffee. Luchadora at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. Bobblehead at the Whiskey Jar. John Dearth and friends at Fellini's, all on the 6th. Every Sunday, we have Travis Elliott at Rapture. Every Monday, the Bluegrass Jam at the Front Porch Roots Music School. Seafoot, the Charlottesville Friends of Old Time Music. Weekly Open Jam at Thomas Jefferson Memorial Unitarian Church.
Where else?
Tango Music with Miles Pierce and Betty Metcalf at the Bebedero. Red and the Romantics at the Whiskey Jar. Onyx Manor at Rapture. And Songwriter Night at the Local.
Yeah, man.
Every Tuesday, Latin Guitar Night with Miles Pierce and Humberto Sales at the Bebedero. The Ragged Mountain String Band at the Whiskey Jar. Traditional Session at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. Every Wednesday, the Mike Rosinski and Jeff Decker Quartet at Miller's. Every Wednesday and Thursday, Josh Mayo's Open Mic Night at 1221 Market Street. Bachata Fusion at the Rabbit Hole. Every Thursday, Humberto Sales and Vincent Zorn do Gypsy Rumba at the Bebedero. And every Thursday.
Every Thursday.
John Dearth at Miller's. All right. And that is your music options this week. We're going to do a drop. We'll be right back here in Homegrown.
This is Mary Gordon Hall. You're listening to Homegrown, your show about local art. 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And what a secret this is.
We're a secret?
Let's hope we're still not a secret.
I don't know.
Working through our third year, let's hope we're still not a secret.
I kind of like being a secret, but then I kind of don't.
It's kind of cool being a secret.
It's cool being a secret.
Hard to get sponsors when you're a secret. Share our secret.
We want to
sell out. We're waiting to sell out.
We're waiting.
34 minutes past the hour. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art. And here we are with our next cherished guest,
yes,
Rich Tarbell.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Absolutely.
What up, man?
Happy to be here. Happy to talk about this little project we got going on.
Tell me about this book.
It's a music town.
It's a music town is the name of the exhibit. It is an exhibit that's going to be presented by the Charlottesville, I guess it's Albemarle, Charlottesville Historical Society.
Mm-hmm.
Coy Barefoot and I co-created, that's hard to say,
yep,
co-curated the
that's
exhibit.
Even harder.
Yeah, so that's where I was going. You guys are so eloquent, I'm going to stumble a little here. So this is the book I wrote. I wrote this last year, and it is a photography book that has an oral history with it. And what I did is I started with a couple people. I started with Jamie Dyer,
mm-hmm,
Terry Allard, kind of a matriarch and patriarch, if you
will.
Of the music scene. And then a younger version of those two is Coda Curl from Chamomile and Whiskey and Sally Rose.
Oh, yeah.
And had each of them pick two people to photograph next. So I started with them. And then,
oh, interesting.
So I kind of had like the older crew kind of, and then Sally Rose and Coda bringing it up for their younger,
mm-hmm,
contemporary. So, they kind of laid the roadmap out to who to photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And quickly, I decided I wanted to do 100 local musicians, knowing that would barely scratch the surface of local music in this town.
Yeah.
But that gave me the roadmap of who to photograph, but quickly I realized it could be more than this. So I did this oral history with it. Mm-hmm. And then I quickly realized the oral history, if I talk to too many musicians, they'll just be nice to each other and compliment, you know, and it won't be that interesting. So I started reaching out to like music industry people, you know, bookers, venue owners, mm-hmm. bartenders, mm-hmm. you know, people like that, writers, to develop this oral history about the Charlottesville music scene. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of rock era stuff. This is what I'm familiar with from living here the last 30 some years. So that's how this was developed. And then Coy reached out to me as the executive director of the Historical Society and said, I've always wanted to do something. I think it's important. What music is in this town is important. I think we should document it. So we decided to do he encouraged me to do this exhibit. So we that's what we're talking about here today.
Cool.
Opens on Friday.
So how did you hook up with the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society? Because I don't think about them being involved in a history like this, a history that's not to bust on the Historical Society, but that's this cool.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. Is I think, and I don't, I hate to speak for them, but it's Coy is trying to take it to a different direction, uh-huh. and maybe less. This is kind of current history mm-hmm. to some degree, in terms of how this town was developed. Music had played a large role in it, and he wants to take. I mean, mine kind of specializes in what I know, mm-hmm. which is the rock era, and mostly the time I've been living here and a decade or two before where it was established. And I think Coy wants to take it back decades before that. He wants to tie it in with Fry's Springs Beach Club. He wants to tie it in all the way back to Jefferson and talk about music in this area. So this is the first step in that. And he just thought it was an opportunity to get this vision he had started.
So specifically, what kind of time frame are you talking about, Bob Bonetta? We're talking about in terms of the rock era. We're looking at like the last 30 years, you say?
I would say for my experience, I came here in 1987.
Right.
Some of those bands that were big at that point, your Skip Castros and people like that, had been mm-hmm. playing for 10 years or 15 years at that point. So this book kind of covers, I guess if you want to round it, say 50 years. Okay. Right. And I think Coy wants to take that back eventually and look at more things beyond that. But this is kind of like the classic era of what most people would know as the local music scene. And what I did is I identified centers of cultural or centers of music influence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just each chapter. There's 15 chapters. Each chapter is not about a person necessarily. It's about centers of influence in music, be it a venue or WTJ radio. It's been a big part over the years in the music scene.
So you say that and I immediately think there's got to be a chapter on Tracks, right?
Absolutely. There's a chapter on Tracks, chapter on Mineshaft. Right. And you can kind of see the music scene move from UVA uh-huh. in the fraternity scene where they were, you know, always having bands for a large, you know, paying them well, to the corner. And then you have a drinking law change. And then you have Mineshaft and Tracks. And now we're downtown, right? There's no bands on the corner anymore. Mm. So the book kind of traces some of that through the oral history.
Cool. I imagine that this must have been fascinating for you. I imagine that you must have learned a lot while you're doing it, or at the very least, I imagine that you must have had a different understanding of music in this town at the end of the project than at the beginning. Was there a difference? Can you talk about what you learned or the journey?
I did try not to dictate the narrative of this too much. I knew kind of where it would go to some degree, but I let it play out. And obviously, talking to certain people, I knew where we were going to some degree. But I learned more about band like the All-Stars was slightly before my time in town. Mm. We're the first band to actually have a commercial record deal. And the only band, really, to have a true commercial record deal until you get towards Dave Matthews. You know, there's write-ups in Rolling Stone and stuff about them. So it's like a little bit more appreciation for what those, I don't know if you'd say pioneers, that's going to make them feel old people. But, but the ones that established what we had at that point, But also the most fascinating story to me that I did not know was a place called Muldowney's. It was on the downtown mall, and it was the first gay bar in Charlottesville, period. Huh.
I remember hearing the name, but I never knew what it was.
And it was a little hole in the wall that you could jam 75 people in type of thing. Obviously, just like every place, they had to have sandwiches or whatever.
Right.
But they were. It was actually a lesbian-owned gay bar, and it was... this is so hard. You know how we always do this. It was where this used to be.
Yeah.
But it's basically as if you looked at what was Mono Loco to the right of that and that Goodyear building. They now build those Waterhouse condos over top of it.
Right.
But in that space, if you will.
Oh, wow.
And what happened was, you know, the punk kids never have a place to play.
Right.
Because a lot of them don't drink. And then a lot of them aren't, you know, of age anyway. And they don't draw a ton of people. But it's so you have this unique group of people coming to this other unique group of people and say, hey, can we play your place? And they said, Muldowney's, they said, yeah, you can have Thursday nights. The first Thursday every month is yours. And they developed this scene. And that was the beginning of the punk scene in Charlottesville. Mm. And bands reference that to this day. That's where we got started. And there, and it, that was the most interesting story to me. You know, it's kind of this, you know, the, I don't want to say social outcast, but back in then, that was pretty radical. And when you're talking, I'm sorry, I didn't reference the years, but we're talking mid 80s, early 80s, where, you know, gay bars, that was a pretty outrageous idea in Charlottesville.
Oh, yeah.
That's not...
Oh, yeah.
Today, we're in a lot better shape from that terms. That was a fascinating story to me.
It's so... just hearing you talk, it's interesting to hear about how in music that... How balkanized music is and how different groups and different subgroups have to find certain niches.
Correct.
And certain scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I try not to be, you know, grumpy old man who's lived in Charlottesville like all the rest of us forever. And we have so much development. And where are these people coming from? But I do that. I mean, I can't help it. I have an urban planning background and what have you. Mm. And so there is some of this of... Where are these artists going to live? Where are these musicians going to live? Right. Where are they going to play? Where are they going to practice? Because we keep building hotels and condos.
Exactly.
Over things where...
Over places for live entertainment.
Right.
Period.
Or
not
even
just
like
music.
Even like a unique place like Random Row Books.
Mm-hmm.
That was
that was a great venue.
Right.
For all different kinds of things.
Exactly. Or community meetings or what have you. And now it's a Marriott. So you kind of got to look at, and I don't know the answer. I mean, I've been studying this forever, but I don't know the answer, but it's kind of difficult when you have this giant influx of people and money or whatever, and what happens to the art and the theater and the people that make the entertainment happen. What do you do? What do you do about that? I don't know, but we've lost some places, and this just kind of documents some of that process.
Yeah, it's really so. I'm so glad that you said that because those are some of the thoughts that I was thinking as soon as you were talking about this and thinking like, wow, you know, it's really interesting to think about the role that place, that space has to play. In terms of the development of scenes and the development of art, but specifically also the development of music. I mean, what happens to, you know, what happens to the history of Charlottesville music if there isn't a Trax, or if there isn't a Tokyo Rose, or if there isn't a Mineshaft? And what, and then, you know, you take another step, say, what hasn't happened for the lack of...
For the lack of places to play.
For the lack of spaces. Like, what could we have had if there were another place that could have held another scene?
Right. Right. And a lot of these things also are people making those scenes. In other words, you have... The Tokyo Rose still exists. You know, the basement's still there, but you don't have a Darius Van Armen or somebody like that that says, we're going to bring in the goth kids and we're going to bring in these touring bands that don't have a place to play between DC and Atlanta or DC and Chapel Hill, and we're going to invite them and feed them sushi and hopefully they'll be cool to play for $50 or
something
like that. So you still need people, and it's that quandary of the people make the scene happen, but you also have to host the people.
You have to host the people, right.
And I don't say that. Obviously, this is about music. So it's what I know. It's also about the teachers and the firemen, the policemen, and everybody else for affordable living. We have to have some options to have this vibrant scene. And I can make arguments that music and Fridays After Five were one of the most significant roles in the development of the downtown mall as we know it today.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Hold on to that, because I certainly want to get back to that. Let's do a drop, and then we will get back to talking with Rich Tarbell. Here we are. This is Homegrown.
This is David Tewksbury, singer-songwriter from Charlottesville, Virginia, and you are listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC.
48 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Homegrown, your show about local art. I'm Clinton, here with Leslie, and this is Rich Tarbell. He's talking about this exhibit coming up that was done in concert with Coy Barefoot, presented by the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society, also made possible, I think, by a donation by Hunter Smith of Champion Brewing.
Yes, very generous donation, absolutely.
Hunter, a friend of music, if there ever was one.
A friend of music and a friend of Charlottesville.
Yes, indeed.
I love the fact that, you know, they've turned their outside into a place that really will. And I mean, Hunter goes out of his way to host not only different kinds of music, but different kinds of art
there on
a regular basis.
And some community meetings, too, and what have you. That, to be honest, if you're a thriving young business, he doesn't have to do that. He's taken some risks, some big risks.
Because a lot of times, you know, a new business just can't afford to like have people use the space without paying for it or, you know, selling tickets or all of that. And he's like, he always says, no, that's cool. Let's do it.
Right. Exactly. So, yes, we're very lucky to have him on board for the production of this exhibit, because we did produce a lot of material, or I did, of collecting a lot of material that's different from this book. This book is portraits. Mm-hmm. The exhibit is more historical in nature.
So is the exhibit your photography exclusively, or is it?
It is inspired by my photography. There are pieces I didn't count up exactly. There might be 25, 30 of my type of pieces, but I've kind of pick and choose what's in there in terms of other people's photography, mm-hmm. or things I've helped with, or things I've collected.
Cool.
So it's more, like I said, there's things that, if you are a music fan in this town, you should come to the exhibit and just take it in. And it's not something, it is a First Friday's opening. It's a First Friday's art opening Friday, April 5th, 5 o'clock to 8 o'clock. We might stay a little later. But it's not going to be something you can grab your glass of wine and blow through in 20 minutes and go to the next exhibit. You're going to want to spend 2 hours. You're going to get sucked into this. I have old band flyers from all the different eras of music. We have the calendar. We have the actual monthly calendars from Tracks. Handwritten calendars from
really?
2 years of Tracks, where, you know, they're booking, you know, every day Matthews Tuesday is written in there.
Right.
They're booking.
That's it. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
There's one funny note. There's Hootie and the Blowfish. You know, I'm not a big Hootie fan, but they were huge.
They were
But the written thing next to it's $150 to Hootie. He got $150, but it was before that first album or first song, whatever
that was. Before he blew up.
Before he blew up. So you have notes like that. It's like, to look back at it, it's kind of amazing.
Wow.
So there's things like, there's plenty to get into.
So Fridays After Five Downtown Mall. When I first moved here in the early 90s, early beginning of the 90s,
yeah.
I worked on the Downtown Mall.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Friday would come up 5 o'clock, and down on the east end of the mall, they would just put up this, you know, right by the Omni, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, they put up this little stage.
Correct.
People get up and play, and you know, this rickety stage. People get up and play, and there was a combination of mall workers who are getting off people who worked around the mall, and you know, local vagrants and transients. And,
absolutely.
You know, and just sort of, you know, doing the wavy dance and just enjoying letting the week defuse off of them.
Absolutely. So what you're describing there, we have some pictures of those days. A couple of originals, but mostly from newspaper articles that I knew were out there. I talked to Kirby Hutto, who's the general manager of the Pavilion now. Mm-hmm. He ran Fridays in the early days, and I'm going to say 91 or 92 for a couple of years after that. And okay. It was to take it from what you're describing. I was the same way. My first job in 1990 was across the street over what's now Lane High School. And I was excited. I was like, oh, 5 o'clock Fridays, you can go listen to bands or whatever. But people don't understand, in the downtown mall, it was underneath the Omni on a temporary stage. That wood came from Tracks. It was like backup stuff from them.
Wow.
Those guys, those stagehands built it. But people don't understand that the mall in those days was, at 5 o'clock, shut down.
Yeah. Right.
It was a retail oriented thing full of old school retailers who did not have an interest in being there past 5 o'clock or much on the weekends.
Right.
So Fridays was kind of invented, Fridays after five, by a downtown business council or what, I don't remember the official names. All of those, to try to bring people in a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really the beginning of trying to integrate some arts into downtown mall, because people just don't understand it's not this boutique cosmopolitan food court that it is now.
Right.
It was, you could shoot a cannon through there after five and not hit anyone.
Oh, yeah.
For a long time. So Fridays became interesting to people and started to draw some crowds, but then it may have been the wrong crowds because the beer was super cheap and whatever. And so I think Kirby came in and made two big changes. He upgraded the beer prices so it's not just giving it away just to get people there. Mm-hmm. And the big thing is he changed it from, if you remember, there used to be a lot of wedding bands that didn't know. They just play cover songs. You know, you play your Commodore songs and everything, just like every wedding you go to. And he changed that to local music.
Yeah.
And so instead of 10 wedding bands on the schedule and maybe two locals like Charlie Pasterfield.
Right. He rotated it.
Flipped it. Mm-hmm. And that continues to this day because we have so much talent in this town.
Yeah.
But now you have people like Terry Allard who's going to bring some people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to draw her own crowd. I heard you mention John DeEarth. People like that to kind of tie in everything to keep it community oriented. So that starts to take off. Dave Matthews plays. We have all those calendars. So Dave Matthews kicked off the 92 season.
Yeah.
You go and, but you'll know everybody on that list. Those bands, a lot of those bands are still together. Coco Motions, people like that. And so Kirby kind of got it going. And then people come to the downtown mall and then you, that was a big, change. The East End had that rickety stage. If you remember, a year or so later, there was a year where they put half the season on the West End.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Kirby was telling me, I remember, it wasn't so much because the business owners on the West End were like, how about us? It was like some of the people on the East End didn't want it. Like beer cups and people partying and whatever.
Really?
Yeah, we have things in the exhibit showing neighbors writing in, clipping an article from the Daily Progress showing people dancing in front of the band playing and saying, this is not what we need downtown.
Really?
Circles not.
Wow.
And anonymous complaints. So it wasn't like the smoothest thing of just, hey, this thing. It was a transition. Change is difficult always in this town.
Yeah,
to start this thing where it went to East End, the West End, and then you had, you know, we followed the construction of the mall as we know it now.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, there was the grassy pavilion the grassy amphitheater.
The grassy amphitheater, yeah.
With the smaller stage. And then they kicked through to LexisNexis with the tunnel. And you have what you see now, which is that picture you were showing earlier where I shot that behind the stage. That's Bob Girard and Alligator, where Fridays, as you know it now, where it's 3,000 people and that all this superimposed on top of that's all the bands that have headlined Fridays after five since it was moved to the Pavilion as we know it now in 2005.
That's a huge list.
It's a huge list, but you're going to know most every name on it.
Yeah.
That's how much local talent we have in this town.
So, Rich, really quickly, we've got just like less than a minute.
Okay.
Like, I see the name of the exhibit. And I also see that it was big in the book. Is it a music town?
So, It's a Music Town is a Terry Allard quote. The last chapter of the book, I tried to ask people, and I could ask you, but you say we only have a minute, but I said, give me the defining music of this town. What if you tell somebody what the music is? It's a hard question. I asked all the musicians, it's a hard question to ask.
Yeah, there's not really a Charlottesville sound,
exactly,
per se.
Exactly. And so that's what the chapter kind of just rambles on about, and you realize that it's so diverse, and there's so many different types of music, and there's so much going on, you can't answer it. But Terry Allard she thought about it, and she's like, it's a music town, period.
Boom.
And I was like, that's it.
Yeah.
There's our mic drop sound, right?
There is.
Rich, thank you very much.
Sure,
it's a music
absolutely.
Town exploring the sights, the sounds, and the stories of Charlottesville in the modern rock era. It's opening Fridays after 5 and going at April 5th and going on till April 30th.
Correct.
At City Space downtown. Go see it. Go see it again. Take people to go see it. It's going to be great. Rich, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, awesome. This was awesome.
All right. And
wow.
That is
Clinton. Clinton, it's been like it was when we first started.
Oh my goodness.
I'm feeling very nostalgic right now.
Are you?
I'm feeling kinda
grooving with that.
Right? And again, we have to say goodbye.
But
it's okay.
Don't worry, fans of David. We hope he'll be back next week, and you won't have to deal with my nastiness.
Hey! Well, all right. And on that note...
we'd like to thank our guests, Jane Allison and Rich Tarbell. Our opening music is from Spit It Out, Inc. Our event music is by Positive Collective. Right now, you're listening to Greg Brown. Any complaints about Homegrown should be directed to our attorneys at the fine Lithman law firm of Tochterman, Overman, Munson & Burke, legal services that wrap around you like a thong. Remember to keep your dial on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
We'll see you guys next week.
See you guys next week.
To Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.